Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and legendary radio health evangelist, Dr.
Self-proclaimed.
Tony. Well, no, I think people say that. Haven't you? I mean, they might say that. They haven't not said that.
Can I take the fifth on this one? I think I need to take the fifth.
I didn't get very far from this show, did I? I couldn't even introduce myself.
That was legendary.
This is our government shutdown show. We are at the present, the time we record this, we are in fact coming out of a government shutdown with a temporary solution, but another shutdown looms as a possibility in the future. So we thought it was time. And after all, Health Matters has been shut down now.
We took what some people would call one heck of a break. Some of you reached out to us and I wouldn't say you complained, but you were definitely excited or curious to have us back on the air. Well, you got your wish.
Yeah, sorry about that. thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, special radio wave to MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center. We are in the midst of an Arctic polar vortex, and we understand it is widespread. So in order to investigate that, we sent Shelley Irving to Isonville to see if it was, in fact, cold in Isonville. She will be back for our next week's show, but she has departed. Here, UK, actually the University of Kentucky shut down because of the polar vortex. The wind chills, of course, were, I heard one TV station analyst say the thermostats would be reading 30 degrees below zero. And I thought, wow, that's a bad thermostat. Anyway, since UK is shut down, we have here the executive director of networking and infrastructure and also non-essential employee, Rick Phillips.
We like to say non-designated. I am not designated.
Well, Rick, since he hasn't really done anything else today, can tell you how to access Health Matters on the internet.
When your internet works. You can. I did spend the day without internet, so Tony's making a little fun of that. To get the audio of the show, go to WMKY.org. That's Moorhead State Public Radio's website. There's a list there of all the shows. You just got to find the site. Once you have the list, you can look at the little summary that's there, and most importantly, find the link to the audio. I think it's there in an MP3 format. You can also get a link there to a podcast, so you can have it automatically delivered to your device as you wish or as you desire. Again, that can be found on WMKY.org. But that is really just listening to Health Matters. That's one-way communication. That's really, really not what you want. You want two-way, right? You want to interact.
It's too passive.
Right. So to interact, go to facebook.com/HM Radio Show, and that you will find is a fan page on Facebook. We're in there. Certainly leave your comments, leave your questions, interact with us. It's your way to get what you want to hear on the air or to suggest show topics. It's, again, it is your way to interact and get some feedback from us. Again, you can do that. It's easy to find. Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, the 10 Healthiest Foods, the foods you should eat as much of as possible. This comes from Kristen Bundy. She's a freelance writer. She did this in the, it's a new service called MD Links, and I get their feed, and I saw this, and I thought, that makes an excellent sponsor. And I will tell you, Rick, how bad I am at this. Many of these foods I can't pronounce. That's about as bad as you can get. Not only do I not eat them, I don't even talk about them.
Do you know what they are? Did you know about them before you read them?
Yeah, I did. But I think you will recognize this is a list of the usual suspects. But these are the things that if you were a healthy person eating a healthy diet, you would want to eat as much of as possible.
Well, how hard is it to say kale?
Turmeric. Or turmeric. It can be either one because it's spelled T-U-R. But I know it is turmeric. Turmeric? Turmeric? You remember it?
Never heard of it.
Okay, bright orange plant, Asian, Central America.
Are we going down 10 to 1 or 1 to 10?
That in random order. 16% of daily iron, don't care much about that. But here's the thing. It does seem to have some anti-inflammatory properties. Again, it's not like you eat something with this in it, your arthritis is cured and your pain goes away. But it does seem to have some antioxidant properties. Now, I actually did eat this. There was an appetizer that had this at a restaurant in Lexington, and I tried it, and it was okay. It was very Asian for me, and for me, I am a very homegrown boy, have trouble with international foods, but okay.
We're going to get some sushi after this?
Yeah, right. And Frances says, well, we're going to try this. She tried it a little bit. She said, we should try this at home, and yet we haven't, and it's been a couple months, but I did have that.
Because you can't get it at Kroger, can you?
Right. Number two. You'll like this. Beans and legumes, right?
And lagoons?
Legumes. I don't know. Legumes. A quarter serving of cooked chickpeas, for example, says Kristen. Cooked chickpeas.
Sure.
You had them? Gotcha.
Yeah, I have.
Okay. 14.5 grams of protein.
I went to Ethiopia, and they were heavy in bean. They were heavy in bean diets.
Lentils, peas, soybeans, peanuts, beans of all sorts, nutritious in their own right.
And what about green?
Yeah, I mean, they're beans. They are beans. And I'll tell you my secret on beans. You know, a lot of vegetables, if I can get cheese on them, I can handle them. Beans, if I put a little salt on them. I'm not a big salt guy, but I decided,
I like beans in my chili.
Yeah, well, let's face it, black beans, very, very nutritious. So at any rate, 1 to 2 servings, half cup of cooked beans per day to take advantage of this. 3, berries.
Of any type?
Right. Raspberries, blueberries, blackberries, strawberries. Black raspberries apparently are cancer-fighting, according to her. I'm not sure about that, but I do know that blueberries and berries in general. I'm a blackberry guy. I really like blackberries.
I like pretty much all the berries.
Well, honestly, the thing about blackberries...
Now, strawberries is my favorite.
Okay, I understand. And I had a strawberry patch as a boy, and it was fun to go out and just eat them straight out of the patch. The thing about blackberries is you have to work hard to harvest wild blackberries.
No, I don't. They're right in Kroger on aisle number three.
I understand what you're saying. But when I was a child and I ate blackberries, it meant that my arms were scratched up. I had jiggers, all the whole thing. But they were a rare treat.
Nobody ever accused you of being legendary.
No. And then number four, we'll stop right there. Asian mushrooms. And they mentioned specifically Asian. They said, don't talk about portobellos or cremini's. You're looking for shiitakes, right? You're looking for maitakes, is that right? And inakitakes.
Why are they so much better over there?
I don't know. It just says Asian mushrooms.
And I mean, shroom's a shroom, isn't it?
No, I trust Kristen. She's got a lot of facts here in this thing. I think she's probably right. That's our sponsor, the 10 healthiest foods you should eat as much as possible. Start our show. It's 5 minutes left. Skip the first section.
Yeah, we've only been going 9 minutes. That's okay, though, you know.
But at some point, we need to talk about health. So I'm going to you see me just trashing the first section of the show.
Hey, we were talking about healthy foods. How can that not be healthy, Tony?
Because of you?
Hey, I'm not the legendary one between the two of us.
That's exactly what you do, see? You just gum everything up, and I can't even talk about health.
In this case, you actually started it.
I know, I did. I should never have said that, but I'm going to say it again just to, I don't know, just, we'll
well,
fight about
like
this.
Well, you like being legendary.
Yeah, we'll fight about this till the next time we shut down. That's what we'll do.
Which could be sooner if we keep it up.
In all seriousness, January 23rd, aspirin for primary prevention. Now, primary prevention means you don't have a stroke, you don't have a heart attack, you may be at high risk, but you haven't had one. What can you do to stop these things from happening the first time?
Is this people who take the baby aspirin every day?
Yeah, and they've not had a heart attack, not had a stroke, they've not got a stent.
They just do it because their grandmother told them to?
Right, or some doctor back in the 1970s told them to, or something like that.
Sure. And there's a certain amount, was it like 52... What's the size of the pill?
Oh, it's an 82 milligram. Yeah. It's a
82 milligram.
Yeah. It's a quarter of a 325. Okay. I guess that's 81. At any rate, we have had 3 very large studies looking at aspirin in the past 5 years. There was one in people who were at high risk for cardiovascular disease, one in people who had diabetes, one in people who were older. Then you add 10 other trials, total of 13, 165,000 participants, over 1 million years of observation. Now, the results of this, the bottom line, the absolute bottom line, aspirin dropped your risk of having a cardiovascular event, a heart attack or a stroke, by 11%. If you were trying to treat people to prevent a heart attack or stroke, you would give 265 people aspirin, and one of them would not have a stroke. I know that sounds weird.
11%?
Yeah, 11%.
Because 11% sounds like 1 in 10.
Well, no, you're right. If everybody had a heart attack or a stroke, it would be 1 in 10. But not everybody has one. So you drop it by 11%. Maybe one, maybe 3 out of the 200 would have it, and you drop it down by 11% to where 2.9 of them would have it, you see. And here's the other side of it. It increased bleeding. Serious gastrointestinal bleed. Got to go to the hospital, maybe get a blood transfusion. Bleeding into your brain. Same as a stroke in that sense, needing hospitalization or any episode of bleeding by 43%. And you start thinking about all these heart catheterizations, all these needle biopsies, all the things we do now where you have to stop the aspirin. I mean, aspirin does carry a lot of side effects. It also carries a lot of pathology. The end result of this, it was a wash. The number needed to cause a bleed to harm, if you treated 200 people for a year, you're going to have somebody who's going to go bad on you. If you treat 265 for a year, you're going to have somebody who's going to be saved.
Just, you're just moving a statistic from one category to the other is what you're saying.
That's correct.
Right. So instead of the two that don't have a heart attack, two people end up with bleeding.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's not like a minor nosebleed. These are hospitalized bleedings, bleeding into the brain. You wind up being as incapacitated as you would be from the heart
attack. So they're of equal caliber.
That's right.
They're just... So basically what you're saying is, I believe several years ago we talked about how aspirin really was looking like it wasn't the wonder drug we thought it was years ago. And Tony, but funny, this show has single-handedly caused me to, I haven't taken aspirin. I can't remember the last time I took aspirin.
Well, I think this may be it. Rick, it may have been a wonder drug.
Now, if they come out and say this about ibuprofen, I'm in trouble.
Yeah, well, ibuprofen, you take it, your pain gets better. I mean, it's an immediate thing. But taking low-dose aspirin to protect yourself from a stroke or a heart attack to make yourself live longer does not work. And I think it's over. I think this is it. This is the definitive statement, and I really don't think. They're
don't
holding
you think,
out.
Though, there's a generation that's going to have to basically pass on with their baby aspirin at the sink,
I told
on the
two
sink.
Patients today, I said, look, I know you've been taking this for over 10 years. And it's very hard just to walk away from something like that. I know it is. But I told them there just is no evidence. As a matter of fact, there is now more than no evidence of benefit. There is an evidence of no benefit. We have looked at thousands, hundreds
I'm
of thousands
sure
of patients.
I'm sure the people who make aspirin wouldn't want
no
you
benefit.
To say that.
Well, what they're saying, I will tell you, they editorialize that, well, it might lower your risk of cancer, and these studies were too short to tell. And I'm going, no, no, no. A million years of observation, no benefit. It's time to end this. We can do better
Very much
than
like this segment.
It's time to end this segment. Take a break. We'll come back with more ridiculousness.
And the legendary Dr. And Tony Weaver.
In our second fractional portion, you're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm the legendary.
You're not even going to get that out now without
Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the government shutdown show. And again,
you are a legend in your own mind.
We were shut down with no pay, I might add. And we were furloughed.
No president shut us down.
Furloughed us, no pay. And I might add, there were no restaurants offering us free meals or free health care.
But he didn't reduce our pay either.
At any rate, we're back.
And we're going to get full back pay.
Our sponsor for the second time, the 10 healthiest foods you should eat as much as possible.
If you can pronounce them.
Yes, turmeric or turmeric. It turns out either one would be correct. Beans and legumes, that's number two. Number three, berries. Number four, Asian mushrooms. Not the portobello, not the creminis, but the Asian mushrooms. Shiitakes in particular, ones that they mention. These should be cooked rather than raw. Anyway, that's what
you're well versed in these.
Yeah, well, this is what Kristen Bundy, and she is a freelance writer. She did a lot of research on this, and I found it. I didn't do a lot of research on this. I found it on one of my feeds called MD Links, and it's a nice summary. Number, I guess we're up to five, maybe. Black cod, also sablefish or butterfish. That's right. You want butterfish. You want the butterfish.
If I'm going to have butterfish, I'm going to cook it in oil and batter fry it.
It is well known for its omega-3s. as much or maybe more than salmon. 2 to 6 servings, about 4 ounces is a serving. So 2 to 6 servings a week, you're looking at 8 to 24 ounces of fatty fish, including black cod, wild Alaskan salmon, herring, or sardines. Rick, do you eat sardines?
No.
I can't even stand the smell of them.
Are anchovies considered a sardine?
You're sitting there with a computer asking me fish questions.
Well, you're legendary. The computer's manual.
Yes, they are, in fact, anchovies.
Why on earth would I use the Google when I got the Weaver?
Well, now, all right. So in truth, do I care whether anchovies are sardines, a type of sardine or not? Because, again, these are things I abhor, things that I can't stand the smell of, and you're asking me to classify them. Well, let's see.
Are they Asian sardines?
Yeah. What about the herrings? What about the sardines? What about the anchovy family? Are they the same family? In fact, is a herring related some way to a sardine? I don't know. I don't like any of them. They are related in that way. They are not welcome in my house.
I use them for bait.
To catch real fish.
Yeah, to catch real fish.
Fair enough. But they are a great source of omega-3s if you can stand them. Next up, ginger. No, not from Gilligan's Island. I know where you're thinking, but no.
No, ginger. I had a dog named Ginger.
Okay. It's anti-inflammatory, anti-nausea. And Rick, you'll love this. It's a carminative. That is a intestinal gas reduction agent, which
why would I
everyone in the studio would appreciate a little ginger for Rick.
You're the one that suggested the beans.
Now, almonds, you got to say.
Oh,
almonds,
of course.
I like almonds.
Yeah, and I won't go as far as drinking almond milk, but yeah. I like almonds.
I don't know how to milk an almond. That's, of course, sorry, that's an old joke, but still, I had to say
it's
it.
It's not that old.
No. Walnuts, I to be honest, I really like nuts. If there is a, if there
Hence
is
our
a health food. Yeah. Thanks. If there is a health food that I can really get on board with, besides the berries, berries and nuts.
Look, every time I go to one of the roadhouses, I eat so many peanuts. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well,
I love peanuts.
Are your way to go. A lot of protein, 6 grams of protein, one serving. That's a handful.
Tony, do you see people doing an evolution in, as far as your lifespan goes? I mean, because when I was younger, I did not like nuts. And it seems like both nuts and soups kind of things, as I've gotten older, you know, your desires change. And I've been, you know, I found things that when I was a kid, I didn't like soup.
I would say I'm a bigger soup guy than I was. Now, nuts in our family, we always got them for Christmas. So, you know, Christmas was the time when we got a bunch of nuts in the house. And so I equate that with holidays. I've always liked nuts. Anyway, almonds.
You like to crack your own walnuts, don't you?
Yeah.
I know you do.
And there's those, the American walnuts, the ones with the really dark flavor. And those are the things that got those hulls you have to use a hammer on. You can't get the open those up. They're not English walnuts, the big beefy walnuts. These are smaller, but man, they taste good. And we had a lot of walnut trees around the house. Next up, bok choy.
I have actually heard of that.
Yeah, it's like lettuce attached to celery. The bottom part celery, right. The top part lettuce, green.
It fits into that category of why on earth would I eat that?
It's a cruciferous vegetable, more beta carotene and vitamin A than most, and consider it as something for your 4 to 5 servings of vegetables per day. I've had some, but not recently. Green tea. Now, the thing about green tea, I am, as you can see, I am at present actually imbibing green tea while we talk.
Tony, what flavor is it?
Okay, it is mixed berry.
Yeah.
So with other natural flavors.
So what, are you trying to hit two of these at once?
No, what I have heard is that this is a Lipton green tea in a bottle, and that's no good. You got to make your own green tea. The store-bought green tea's not really all that beneficial in terms
of I've yet to find any of them that taste good. Now, my wife loves green tea, and I'm sure there's something wonderful about it for her, but I just never liked it. And, you know, we tend to eat in a Japanese restaurant every once in a while, and the Japanese restaurant has green tea ice cream. And that just doesn't do it. I need my ice cream nice and sweet.
I agree. I wouldn't eat green. And I will tell you, I didn't like green tea. I taught myself to drink it because I thought it was going to be good for me, and then it's not.
And how many people you think have done that with coffee?
I'm still working on coffee right now, as a matter of fact.
I drink coffee 2, 3, maybe sometimes 4 cups a day, and I know I drink it black, and, you know, I get to start telling myself, how on earth did I ever fall in love with that flavor?
No, it smells good, and it just tastes a little bit bitter, but if you can get over that, it's good for you. But green tea was again, this is coming from Kristen. Kristen says green tea is the right thing. Kristen Bundy, freelance writer, publishes in MD Links, and that's where I latched onto it. And then finally, fermented foods. Interesting enough, they mentioned yogurt, of course, but they also mentioned sauerkraut. Sauerkraut and sardines are just right there. If I were on some kind of a contest, like Big Brother, and they brought out sauerkraut and sardines and said, all right, you have to eat this or you get kicked out of the house, I'd pack my bags.
Well, what if they brought out one or the other, not both?
Sorry.
I love sauerkraut. I mean, sauerkraut's good. That's another thing I didn't like when I was a kid.
Well, I kept not liking it. See, I'm more consistent than you are. That's the thing. And then finally, kefir and
kimchi.
You're
incapable of change.
That hurts. It's true, but it hurts.
No. Don't you mean it stings?
Now, this is, if you listen to the last week's show, this is a rerun. Fast forward your MP3. But I wanted to come back and look at this again because I didn't really feel like we did it justice.
You know why? We had too long a break.
Because you wouldn't stop talking. That was the whole
problem. Look, you asked me to talk, and I did.
All right, so first of all, there were three segments to this, and I'll just run through the first two quickly because I want to get to the third. The first was from the Houston Chronicle, December 20th, Dan McCoy, president of Blue Cross Blue Shield Texas, and says, we need a moonshot to reverse the downward trajectory of rural health care. And his points, which I really liked, he gave several examples of what was happening in rural Texas, exactly like rural Kentucky. But then he said, the future of rural health care is not urban health care lightened up or adapted. The future of rural health care is not driving people to
urban areas.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the real future may not be solvable from an urban perspective. But he said, look, we need to get our universities involved in looking at rural health care challenges. It's tough. I mean, the way we see universities, they basically stay in the university. There are universities that get out in the communities, and they might have a shot at that. He's working, partnering with Texas A&M to try to get some unique rural solutions. And they're asking things like, is the goal of rural healthcare to preserve the hospital, or is it to replace the hospital with something that is more efficient and more adapted to the current needs of rural communities? What would be the ideal mix of delivery of live stuff and virtual stuff through telemedicine, and what does a rural community really need? It's a fascinating question.
Tony, I think it's you've hit something that I think is has a lot of incredibly deep thought that could be applied to it, because really what you just said was the urban healthcare systems have to understand rural healthcare needs, and rural healthcare needs have to understand the urban systems. Which is, if you take out the word healthcare, that applies to our United States of America that we're living in right now. There's so much going on that there's this urban-rural conflict. Urban wants rural to be urban, and rural wants urban to be rural, right?
Yeah.
When we really just need to understand the two and realize there's a need for them, we got to figure out how to move forward with both, not try to assimilate one to the other.
I will never forget, we had a researcher, and she was, this was the University of Kentucky, she was looking at trying to lower cervical cancer rates, and sent volunteers out to talk about cervical cancer screening to women's Bible study groups in rural southeastern Kentucky, and made an excellent presentation, really enjoyed her presentation, and then asked for questions. And the first question that came up was, how do you keep your people safe when they go to these rural areas? And keep in mind, they were going to women's Bible study groups. How do you keep your people safe when they go to a woman's Bible study group? In the same way,
safe from what? Eating bad potluck?
In the same way, though, my patients, I'll say, I think you need to go to Lexington to see a specialist.
Well, I can't go at night, or I can't go in the dark.
Well, you don't think there'll be a drive-by shooting at the clinic, do you? And the idea that UK or the Lexington Clinic would have a drive-by shooting at the patient entrance, fair enough.
At all.
Sounds like I'm isolating an area of UK where they don't do drive-bys. But but in all reality, then neither side understands the other.
Exactly.
And fears,
But I think what they're trying to get to here is, from a healthcare standpoint, that the solution is understanding both and moving forward, not trying to assimilate one into the other.
So what aroused my interest in this, besides the fact that I read that and I thought, this guy, even though he didn't have solutions, he spoke, there was a pretty intelligent thing that he was talking about. This was November 5th, back in November 5th, President Eli Capiluto of the University of Kentucky, Mark Evers, who is the chief at the Markey Cancer Center, they said, we believe that we aim at the University of Kentucky to cut our cancer death rate in the state of Kentucky in half. There are 10,500 or so people in the state of Kentucky that die of cancer every year, and so they want to cut that down to essentially 5,000 deaths per year. Now, first of all, in an ideal world, that is very doable because many of these deaths are very preventable. But in order to do it, once again, UK is going to have to adopt, as Rick mentioned, rather than trying to look at this as a problem of chemotherapy or lack of genetic data, is it is about working in communities and trying to develop a rural solution. Because in fact, in Kentucky, the majority of the cancer deaths due to lung cancer and other cancers are in the rural areas.
Right.
So we've got to work within the community. Give you an example, lung cancer. Of the 10,000, around 3,500 every year die of lung cancer. Completely or almost completely preventable. We could get that number down to a few hundred.
Sure.
But
I mean, I think it's going to be a little higher than a few hundred, but we can certainly put the majority dent in it.
Right. And we even know how to do it. We would have to increase the tax on cigarettes. Because other states have done that, and their smoking rates are lower than ours.
But we also got to look at, I mean, this particular state has a longstanding history with that product, from growing it, from processing it, from putting it up at auction. I mean, it's been a part of some people's lives here for, you know, 60, 70, 80 years. I mean, it's going to be hard.
And it's killing us.
No, absolutely agree with you. But I'm just saying it's more systemic than just let's raise the taxes. I think that's a good first start. That's going to keep people from starting.
Yeah.
But there's this group that's going to have to wash through the system, unfortunately.
Yeah. And we right now, Kentucky has raised its tax, but we're still in the middle. The states with the highest drop in cancer deaths have a higher tobacco tax. The other thing, ban indoor smoking. Again, other states have done this. We know that is beneficial in reducing smoking rates. It makes it harder for people to take up smoking. And we have the nation's highest rate of smoking. So just doing those things, we could start to cut into our lung cancer rates. And then there is a screening test for lung cancer now, a CT scan of the chest done every year in people who are 55 to 77, Medicare says, and have smoked for more than 30 years and have quit less than 15 years. An annual CAT scan would also pick them up. And we could save some people, maybe 20% of our lung cancer people from dying of lung cancer if we did universal screening here. So, again, we're talking of hundreds of lives saved if we were simply able to target lung cancer. Now, in terms of our cancer death rates, 850, the second most common cancer cause of cancer death in Kentucky, is colon cancer. We dropped from 3,500 with lung cancer down to 850 with colon cancer. Whitney Jones is a gastroenterologist in Louisville. He's been on this show before. I'm in amazement at what he's been able to do. He started the Colon Cancer Prevention Project, and since it started, Kentucky's death rate due to colon cancer has dropped by 25%.
Wow.
So, you know, if Markey Cancer Center wants to get our death rates down by 50%, they ought to talk to Whitney Jones, who almost, I mean, there were a lot of people helping him, I know, but he started a program that has been associated with a 25% drop in colon cancer death rates. And what it was quite simply, colon cancer, once again, very preventable if we screen, and he dedicated himself to making screening more available and was able to impact that. The Markey Cancer Center did mention vaccination, HPV vaccination, which prevents cervical cancer and perhaps some types of oral cancers as well. Certainly we need to get our HPV vaccination, human papillomavirus vaccine rate much higher than it is now. Ours is fairly low, actually. They have expanded the indications. You can get it up to age 45 now, whereas it used to be you had to get it before age 26 or you couldn't get it. Marquis will be doing smoking cessation classes. That's part of the Cancer Moonshot program that Joe Biden inaugurated. This should help UK to train people to help with smoking cessation. I'll tell you the other thing, you know, this is kind of surprising, but our behind breast cancer, pancreatic cancer, and prostate cancer, liver cancer at 341, much of that is due to hepatitis C. Needle exchange programs and testing people for hepatitis C. We could drop our cancer rate. But we would have to really work hard at trying to get universal testing and treatment in place. And it's going to cost a lot of money.
You know, and you know, while I don't have a strong public health background, you know, it just seems to me that we're going to really have trouble getting down when these numbers start getting down in these percentage points, you know, single digit kind of things like that. It's going to be so hard to want to overlook those and try to solve things like less car crashes and, you know, things that are more preventable.
Yeah.
That have higher numbers. I mean, you and I, Tony, we talk about this every year. How many, all these deaths right here still don't hold a candle to influenza.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, maybe, you know, at some point, I fear for the people on the bottom of this list are not going to get the kind of progress they're hoping for. That's
a
fear.
But lung cancer, 3,500, preventable.
Absolutely.
Colon cancer, 850, preventable through screening. Breast cancer, obviously mammography, 600. Mammography is pretty well adapted. It's going to be tough on breast cancer. Pancreatic cancer, we don't have a screen for it, 574 every year. Prostate cancer, it's going to be tough to reduce it. Liver cancer, we can do something about that. Cervix cancer, only 72 people. But, yeah, we can, with HPV vaccination, with
I just think it's an uphill battle. That's all I'm saying.
It's difficult. I mean, but, you know, there are some other things. We know that physical activity, we know that reducing obesity rates, we know that eating more fruits and vegetables lowers your rate of a number of cancers, dozens of cancers.
Right.
So if we were to adopt a healthier lifestyle, If we were to adopt a healthier lifestyle, we could make a serious dent in these cancers. Maybe not 50% reduction, but we could get somewhere. But it starts in the community. We're stopping in the community right now because, once again, we have run out of time.
It's time,
sadly,
for some Asian mushrooms.
That's right. And we'll come back with our third and final fractional portion on Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters and our last fractional portion with the legendary Dr. Tony Weaver. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm just Tony Weaver.
The legendary. You are
first name Tony,
legendary.
Last name Weaver. That's it. MD, but still. This is the government shutdown show. We are back from our shutdown just in time to talk about.
And we're
going to
shut down after this show.
Yeah, but we'll be back next week, maybe. If we don't get furloughed, this the sponsor for the last time, the 10 healthiest foods you should eat as much as possible. And again, much credit. All thanks go to Kristen Bundy, who is a freelance writer writing for MD Links and did a very nice job on this. And I'll just remind you, turmeric, beans and legumes, berries, Asian mushrooms cooked. And we're talking about the shiitake mushrooms, black cod, ginger, almonds, bok choy, green tea, and fermented foods such as, unfortunately, sauerkraut, but yogurt, which I happen to like, and kefir, which is supposed to be sort of yogurt that you don't have to refrigerate. So that's our sponsor, and eat those foods. Pick the ones that you like. Try the ones that you aren't certain about, and don't eat sardines because they are slimy and they smell.
But if Francis went out and bought some, you could use them in your pond. For fishing bait.
I would not eat a fish that ate sardines.
Wow.
I mean, it's just, our producer was shocked. He said, what's wrong with fish that eat sardines?
Do you know what those fish swim around in? Does it matter really what they eat?
I swim around in what they swim around in.
Well, that's my point.
I don't know how this got to be an indictment of me, but I think let's just walk down the hall and just start polling people about who eats sardines. I think sardines, I think overall, and we will revisit
this. I'm not going to do that to anybody.
Sardine production in the United States, I believe, may be tailing off a little bit. I think the generation wires are probably not eating as much sardines as were eaten back in the Great Depression when you didn't have food. Just pointing that out in a roundhouse way. God, Rick, you just make me mad, and when I get mad, I just start spouting. But this is British Medical Journal, 2019, published 23rd of January, an article that you should know about, Rick. It's called Association of Fried Food Consumption with All-Cause Cardiovascular and Cancer Mortality. And it's even a prospective cohort study. What that means is you start looking at this up front. You don't just wait till everybody has done things and dust has settled and you said, all right, I wonder how many of those people ate fried foods. You divide them up into the fried food eaters and the non-fried food eaters, and you watch and see what happens. This is important. 25 to 36% of North American adults consume foods, usually fried, from fast food restaurants every day.
Okay.
Do you question that?
No.
Okay.
Now,
so they are very commonly consumed, and how bad are they?
They're probably pretty bad.
I will tell you how bad they are because I have a prospective cohort study published in the British Medical Journal that tells me, first of all, how do we identify the people who ate fried foods? They gave them a questionnaire. Total fried food consumption, following three items: fried chicken, fried fish or shellfish, and other. I think fried chicken and fried fish or shellfish is pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Other includes French fries, fried potatoes, fried rice, fried cassava, and fritters, snacks such as potato chips, corn chips, tortilla chips, pork skins, Ritz and cheese crackers, fried plantains, taco and tostada, flauta, crispy roll taco, Indian fried bread, all on that questionnaire.
No,
do you eat
no
those
cheese,
things?
No cheese sticks, no...
No, they didn't mention that. Ritz, I was a little surprised,
no jalapeno
but Ritz
poppers.
Is fried.
No pizza rolls.
So you could probably, you think you could get away with that? And I don't know what else. Those were among the questions.
I'm just saying, I can't think of anything good you'd put in the deck.
Yeah, give you that. But at any rate, I mean, the big three again, fried chicken. And I will point out to you that beef was not one of their fried foods.
I didn't notice that. I didn't see that you said anything about fried Oreos either.
No.
But, you know, some good deep fried Oreos.
All right. With knowing that about a third of North American adults eat at fast food restaurants, and much of the food at fast food restaurants is fried, then this is a concern. And again, I wanted to make sure that you understood what we were asking them. This was the Women's Health Initiative. You know, we've seen a number of studies out of the Women's Health Initiative, 40 clinical centers in the United States. They follow these people. They give them a bunch of questionnaires. This particular questionnaire was given in the early 1990s, and then they follow them for 20 years. And so up until February 2017, they were watching these women who either ate or didn't eat fried foods to see what would happen with them. They were age 59 at study entry, and so the 50-year-olds in the 1990s, again, were going to be in their 70s and 80s in the 2000s. So they did that, and their outcome measures was very simple. They watched to see if they died, all-cause mortality, cardiovascular mortality, and cancer mortality. So they didn't really care whether you had a heart attack or not. The question is, did you die of your heart attack, or did you die of your cancer? There were 31,000 deaths. 373,000 people did the initial. They had 68,000 subsequent in the clinical trial and 93,000 in the observational study. They had tens of thousands of women filling out the questionnaires, and 31,000 of them died over the next 20 years. For total fried food consumption, if you look at one serving per day of fried chicken, fried fish, fried shellfish, or fried other stuff versus none, you had about an 8% higher risk of dying of anything and an 8% higher risk of cardiovascular mortality.
Okay.
Now, think about that. Would you trade an 8% higher risk of dying for 20 years of fried chicken?
Does it have to be fried chicken, or can it be just all the fried foods in general?
Yeah. Okay. One serving of fried
I think
foods.
I've already made that determination. I think I already made that deal 20 years ago.
Well, it puts a number on it, so you can think about it. When comparing at least one serving per week.
Tony, I think you did too.
Of fried chicken with none. It was actually a 13% higher for all cause mortality and 12% for cardiovascular. So we're looking at 8 to 12%, you know, right around there. And then for fried shellfish in particular, fried shellfish, 7% all cause and 13% for cardiovascular. Total fried or individual food consumption not associated with cancer mortality. So if you eat fried food, you can expect pretty much at any level once a week or more fried chicken, fried shellfish, or fried other, you're going to run between 7% and 13% higher mortality rates over the course of this study than if you didn't. Now, it sort of surprised me. Okay, fried foods are not good for you. That wasn't as – I'll be honest, that wasn't as bad as I thought.
So let me ask you this, and I'll get to my reason after you answer the question.
I will get to my point eventually.
Why do you think it's the act of frying the foods in oil, or is it the foods themselves? So, a.k.a. I got an air fryer for Christmas – and I've been using an air fryer to fry things that I normally – well, we didn't really have a deep fryer in the house for many, many years. But, I can cook, wedge potatoes, or I can cook, certain things with the air fryer now. And they turn out, really good, just like you fried them in oil, but they're not. There's no oil involved.
Right.
So the question is that better?
I'm glad you asked, Rick, because I have – I don't have theories. The authors of this article in the British Medical Journal have theories.
And you concur?
I will read them. And we will let our listeners decide whether they concur or they discur.
Love it when I get your full opinion.
But here's this is really kind of unique. At the end, it said possible explanations of findings, which I think is really interesting. First of all, several possible explanations. One, the food could lose water and absorb fats during frying. And again, your air fryer, you absorb air, that's fine. That could increase the energy density of the food. And so frying could lead to excess energy intake also by making the food more appealing. Because fried chicken is really good.
Right.
And so is it higher density, higher caloric density? Is it the fact that it tastes better so you're going to eat more? Additionally, though, frying does deteriorate the oils through the process of oxidation, loss of unsaturated fatty acids, and an increase in trans fatty acids, which we know are bad for you. Now, what if the question then becomes, well, what if you did it at home, you fried, and you changed out the oil after every meal?
You didn't use oil at all.
Yeah. You've got that air fryer thing, don't you?
I'm looking for confirmation. Yeah, confirmation.
Okay. But they said in their study, the associations persisted after adjusting for total energy intake. So it is not that they were eating more. And also for trans fatty acid intake, suggesting the associations could not fully be explained by increased energy intake, increased fats. So I'll be honest with you, they really don't know. Frying at high temperature can lead to acrylamide formation in the foods. Maybe it is something that you do when they're fried at high temperature. And that'd be bad for your little escapade here, Rick.
It's still 390 degrees.
Right. So if you fry them at high temperature, perhaps that induces a chemical change in the food itself. Possibility.
Okay.
Perhaps the cancer mortality, dietary intake of the acrylamide might not be high enough to have an effect on cancer mortality. Maybe it's because there were too many different kinds of cancers. They mentioned that. And then finally they said, well, some of the fried foods could be ultra-processed foods that are high in sodium, and maybe it's the stuff you put in the fryer and not actually the fryer itself. I think not. You mean if you had a gourmet fried food, it would be safer? I don't think so.
So, that's how you make the best cordon bleu, right?
Yeah.
Just put it in the deep
French
fryer.
French chicken.
Right.
Yeah, and it goes in the fryer, and that right there is such high-quality chicken that it doesn't have the other stuff that comes in. So we've got several things. It's not the calories. I mean, the calories are not good, but when they tried to adjust for the fact that there was a difference in caloric intake or a difference in the person's weight, they could not find that it was clearly linked to an increased caloric intake. There was something else. Was it then a change in the fats themselves? Was it absorption of the fats into the food? Was it the temperatures causing a change in the food? Was it the food you put in the fryer? You can see, I mean, they're casting around here. To be honest, they don't know. I mean, they honestly don't know. But I wanted our radio fans to know. I mean, I looked at that, and frankly, an 8% increased risk, you get the idea that fried foods are just death on a stick or death in a basket. But maybe not. Maybe, I mean, they're not healthy.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing is, in the last 50 years, there's been such a rise in fried food because of fast food. You know, you have to prepare the food fast, obviously, or you're not going to be qualified as a fast food restaurant. And so, you know, deep frying is one of the fastest ways, especially 20, 30 years ago. You know, there was no real convection ovens. There was none of this microwave. I mean, all this stuff has kind of come around in the last 50 years. And so, I mean, but it's crazy how much your fast food is fried.
Right.
And so...
That's interesting. So I don't think microwaves have saved lives, do you? They're a different, an alternative way of preparing food fast. So maybe people who would eat fast food would simply microwave. But I don't think they, I've never seen anything about microwave food being
worse for you.
Or better.
Right. Because, well, because I mean, if I make vegetables and the next day I warm them up in my microwave.
What have you done? I mean, if it's the high temperatures, that microwave is certainly inducing chemical change in your green beans.
Yeah. I mean, I think preparing food, I think we live in such a fast-paced society that I think having to prepare the foods fast means you have to hit it with high temperatures and you have to come up with ways to do it quick. And
yeah.
I think you know, maybe she's on to something. But that doesn't bode well for my air fryer, which is really what I was trying to get you to validate.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There are enough mechanisms there that the air fryer itself could be causing problems. And that would be, like you said, frying without the fats might still be a problem because you are rapidly heating this food and it might induce some type of degradation. They don't know. I mean, we still haven't gotten to the heart of this thing. I will tell you, you know, if there is some chemical that makes food not healthy, sardines have a lot of it.
I've never used deep fryer to fix sardines.
Well, you could microwave a sardine and it's still not healthy. I mean, sure, Kristen says sardines are healthy, but I'm going to go back. My body has developed. I mean, I have evolved a warning system to tell me when food is not good for me. And
not
sardines
good.
Are just
not,
set off every alarm that I've got.
It's when it's not good, not necessarily good for you.
Well, no, I mean, you know, this taste thing that I've got warns me that food might be bad. It might be rancid. It might carry germs. I'm sorry, I wander. I could just go back to the sardines. Why in God's name? But at any rate, Kristen says they're good. I mean, we think steaming is really the way to go. But
or honestly, direct fire. I mean, yeah, right?
No, but grilling is not.
We think grilling's bad?
We do.
No, I'd have left the show if you'd have said that. There's no way that can be true, because I'd have left years ago if that was true. I can't be a part of that, Tony. I cannot get on board where grilling is bad.
Crockpots are the wave of the future. Because, I mean, if suddenly heating something is a bad idea, that's your theory. That's what you said.
No.
Fast
that's your theory.
Fast is fast, and so that's what's wrong with it. If that's the case, then it's clear that we just need to put everything in a crockpot.
I'm saying that deep fryers have become the norm in fast food restaurants.
True. The ones that don't microwave.
Well, I mean, I think they do a combination of things.
Yeah.
No, but I think you're still going to get the fries, the finger food fries, the side dish to go with whatever's at the fast food place is done in the fryer.
Yeah, and so if you get if you get fried chicken with broccoli, steamed broccoli with a fried chicken.
You don't get that in fast food. You don't eat out much, do you? Tony,
more than you can.
You're going to have a better chance if we get out of here. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilber, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember these properties Health Matters shares with probiotics.
What is Health Matters?
Health Matters contains live microorganisms that are intended to have health benefits. Products sold as probiotics include foods such as yogurt, dietary supplements, and Health Matters. Although people often think Health Matters is harmful, many microorganisms help our bodies function properly. For example, bacteria are normally present in our intestines, and they help digest food, destroy disease-causing microorganisms, and produce vitamins. Large numbers of microorganisms live on and in our bodies. Many of these in Health Matters are similar or the same as microorganisms that naturally live in our bodies.
What do we know about the usefulness of Health Matters?
Health Matters may help prevent diarrhea that's caused by infections or antibiotics. We may also help with symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. However, benefits have not been conclusively demonstrated, and it's not all Health Matters shows have the same effects.
Well, what do we know about the safety of Health Matters?
Well, in healthy people, our shows usually have only minor side effects, if any. However, in people with underlying health problems, for example, a weakened immune system, serious complications such as infections have occasionally been reported. Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.